Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I'm Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this show is dedicated to the Russian Orthodox Nationalist mission, focused largely on Russian and Ukrainian history and politics, but the overarching purpose is that the Orthodox Slavic world is the force, in terms of organization and power, the exclusive force, that is hammering away at globalization, what we call the New World Order, which is what the fathers called Antichrist, this entity that will actually take over the planet, and it will do so through economic and political means, largely using deceit and people's lust for power and money and justification. To solidify themselves. It is informal. People have a tendency to personify power. Where even educated people start referring to like the president's domestic agenda or how the president's going to tackle unemployment, not realizing that the president has no authority in those areas, is not meant to have any authority in those areas, and there would be no reason for a president to have an economic plan at all. The personification of power suggests that Americans or people in general are naturally monarchists. That's the primal ingrained idea that power is the father of the family. And it's concentrated in one person, at least symbolically, and that person is responsible for everything that happens. So presidents are seen as dictators, as leaders, not just of the country, but of the free world. And I have to chuckle at this stupidity. Presidents are not meant to have much power. It was originally a part-time job. Their goal essentially was to oversee their cabinet, which they could hardly do. And then the cabinet, of course, is meant to enforce the laws passed by Congress. The president can say yes or no, and that's about it. Foreign policy is a little different. Now, in America, foreign policy is run largely by corporate capital, energy companies, military suppliers, of course, the big banks, certain manufacturing concerns, computers, automotive. They have a small army of researchers and policy people, and they staff the big think tanks. And presidents, you know, have no particular, you know, when was the last president that had any knowledge of foreign policy? Richard Nixon, for better or for worse, was probably the last one that had any functional knowledge. Woodrow Wilson, probably before him. So they're quite explicitly meant to be figureheads. But that concept is not really an insult. I think the Federalist Party understood that that power has to be personified. In the colonial era, George III was the symbolic head of the British Empire that was allegedly oppressing the Americans. George III had very little power in general, and certainly had very little power over the colony. The Parliament that profited from that, and that created that whole system. And of course, you had these like the British East India Company, these public-private like state universities today. They're privately run, but they're chartered by the state. They're enforced monopoly. Those are the entities that had power. But how can you personify that in a poster or in rhetoric? So this, you know, the picture of a big fat king on a throne works quite a bit. In my last podcast, I spoke about Rasputin, and they loved that image. You know, the guy dressed in black with the long beard. And it was so easy to personify a guy like him, even more so. I mean, Nicholas and Alexander were fairly popular. And the economy had done well up until that point, and so they needed someone else. And that's what that role. So you're talking about the politics as a theater of the irrational. The problem is that liberal democracy and the free market are based entirely on the rationality of people who are living within it. liberal democracy believes that human beings are seekers of truth, not self-interest. That they are objective. That they are willing to waive. I mean, the whole concept of political debate, open debate and discussion is prefaced on that idea. And that when they go to the polls, they have, you know, a lengthy list of reasons, pro and con, for each one. Now, no one believes that. We have to thank psychology for the revelations that we all could see every day, that people are irrational, that people are almost completely unaware of their motives, that they can lie to themselves so well that they truly believe what they're doing is okay. And none of us are innocent of that. None of us are. I mean, part of the Orthodox life, though, is to look at yourself as objectively as humanly possible, which is awful at first, because you don't usually see anything good. The more objective you look, the better off you'll become. Nothing bad can come of truth. Nothing bad can come of a lifestyle that's based on it, even if it's painful. And the free market, of course, is similar. It assumes that people have full, Adam Smith said explicitly, that people have full knowledge of the products that they're buying and can compare and contrast, that they know the sellers, usually personally, that they know what their self-interest is, they know what they need versus what they want, and they know how to budget their money such that it all works out. No one believes this. So you have a political system, a social system, an economic system based on things that psychology has blown out of the water. I say that because one of the things that's noticeable is the weird, every presidential race, I always laugh because they think the president is this godlike being. If he is elected, therefore that group that he represents has taken over, like it's a coup. Presidents have minimal power, even in foreign policy. Foreign policy, they have to deal, as I said, with corporate capital, who already has an army in place, deeply involved in these policy areas. Of course, the specialist committees in the House and Senate dealing with certain geographic areas also do most of the research. The State Department and DOD have hundreds of thousands now of unionized, experienced bureaucrats who aren't going anywhere, and they continue their work. It doesn't matter who's president. So I always use the example of Italy, that from 1945 to I think the early 90s, they had a government every few months. It just rose and fell. Parties. It was a joke. It was nothing was legitimate after Mussolini. I think it was a new government every 9 or 10 months, if I'm not mistaken. In Italy. And yet at the same time, she was stable. She developed into a major industrial power, part of NATO and everything else, no differently than any other society in Western Europe. Well, that proves then that politicians don't matter. What matters is bureaucracy, the private sector, the media, for good or for ill. So I want to remind people of that. I'm trying to stay above the garbage that's going on. In the post the Trump election, his election doesn't mean that the right wing has taken over. It doesn't mean that the government is now controlled by him. That's ridiculous. It doesn't mean that he's going to fix things. He doesn't have that power. That would be, you know, no one would have agreed to that in the convention debates in the late 18th century when the U.S. was being formed. The presidential power, in fact, was the subject of tremendous debate. Everyone thought he had too much power, so that was constantly pared back. Always remember that the U.S. government as a machine was meant to be slow, irritating, cumbersome, and really pretty much a failure. And that's a good thing, because that means they can't take the place of natural institutions like local governments and families and guilds who were supposed to have power. The whole point of creating a constitution where you have three branches always fighting each other, is that powerful people will go there to carve out their territory, but they'll be too busy with turf wars to worry about what's going on at home. And it's a failure, not because of any lack of wisdom on the founders, the Federalist Party, but because there's no way they could have predicted the massive conglomerate that has more power, than all, 18th century governments put together. They could never have even conceived of those conglomerates having media control, deciding not only what's true and what's false, but what's real, who's guilty, who's innocent, what issues are important, what politicians you're going to vote for, what you wear, what you listen to. Again, no one's innocent of that either. Now, therefore, they could not see that. They couldn't see the sheer size of the federal bureaucracy. And they could not possibly have predicted, in the Federalist Party anyway, that these conglomerates would work together and create this hybrid, this kind of a monster of corporate capital and the public sector, creating something new that really doesn't even have a name, but I gave it a name a long time ago, the regime. Recently, someone has referred to it as the deep state, and as always, that is what's being used. Although in my case, the regime is far larger than the state. The deep state is the state is not the issue. We're not talking about states anymore. I refer to it as a regime with a capital R because it's neither private nor public. But a new vocabulary to describe this stuff hasn't developed yet. Nationalists and Christians really don't have the intellectual firepower to do that. My stuff, no one really pays attention to the people who matter. So all these things that I've been talking about for years suddenly become commonplace, and everyone forgot where they came from. But the regime refers to the New World Order. It refers to what they refer to as a deep state. That's one relatively small part of an entire global network of these private-public entities. You can't tell a difference anymore. So I need to say that given the fact that debates in America have largely ceased, the only way to have a real debate is someone who you know, who respects you already, and so you can have a familiar discussion. Two strangers, it's not going to happen. The ego, the emotions, the creation of this monstrous human being the media has pulled off make discussion impossible. People don't seek truth. They seek power. They seek justification. They seek pleasure. So that's really all irrelevant anyway. But if you're going to debate somebody, you do it only once you realize that the person is an honest seeker, a person who's come to their opinion, however erroneous, honestly. And that your job then is, the word dialectic refers to just this: two people who know each other, two people who have a lot in common. They speak the same language, they're part of the same entity. They're divided over a specific issue, and when they discuss it, slowly the resolution will show itself. So debate, in the Greek concept of dialectics was people of the same ethnic group, speaking the same language, who generally agreed on most things. And then the debate would develop only because the end goal was the same. They wanted a certain, they wanted peace with a faction or something. Everyone agreed with that. It's just the debate was over how to do it. So you can't have debate in a multicultural society by definition. In the original sense of the word dialectic, dialectic referred to people who are part of one body coming to agreement over something through discussion. The assumption there is that they're honest, that they know how they're using terms, that they're both at the same educational level, same experience, that they're speaking the same language in all senses of the word, and they have a lot in common. Otherwise, there is no debate. There's only power. But apart even from that, rationality is dying. I've been spending a lot of time studying logical fallacies recently because I'm realizing that even highbrow debates are loaded with them. People don't understand even basic logical progression anymore. And you can't point it out to them because then you get yelled at and you're an elitist and everything else. So speaking of which, I discussed that to get into my topic, which I've been hesitant to bring up here. Alex Alosev, who was one of the major, if not the major, 20th century Russian religious philosopher, almost nothing is in English of his. That's no accident. The things that are in English, a few of the big journals have run issues dedicated to him. But the problem is that they're mostly translated from other languages. And so they're not very good, only because the translations are problematic. And the translator may not have realized the technical definition, that they're using terms like will or understanding or concept or idea in a technical way, in a Hegelian way. If you don't know that, you're going to translate that maybe as something similar. So it's almost impossible to read. You know, Hegel uses, and Kant uses these terms in a very, very specific way. You have to know their system first. But a translator may not know that. And so when they're putting these things together, it sounds very awkward because they're translating literally using conversational definitions of terms like that, and you have to start reading between the lines. So in Loss's case, I read nothing in English. I went to the original, which is extremely difficult. And the reason I was hesitant to bring him up is because he's primarily a metaphysician. He sought out to create at least the foundations of a Russian Orthodox philosophy, to bring the patristic world into the same world as modern philosophy, at least in the sense that we're using the same language and realizing that certain concepts from Hegel's philosophy in particular, or Schelling, or Husserl, people like that, are actually usable. That some of the insights of Hegel, for example, is very useful to make sense out of the ancients, and that's true. And so what he's doing is very foundational. He lives in the Soviet era. He was arrested several times. He went to a labor camp. He knew powerful people, and he stayed. He never went into exile. He died in the 80s. And, it's very odd that he's promoting a very, very Orthodox worldview. And although he did spend time in a labor camp, he seemed to know people that kept him safe. Or maybe they just didn't think that he was worth it. In fact, he won a state prize for philosophy near his death, I believe it was 85. Losef is very difficult, as any Hegelian would be. I'm realizing that one of the great strengths I have in coming into the Russian Orthodox world is that I spent years upon years poring over Hegel. Plato and Hegel should be taken care of together. But Hegel is very daunting. Hegelians don't know what he's talking about most of the time. And you have to be very, very patient. Unfortunately, the 19th century and 20th century Russian mission is being laid out in Hegelian terms. The Slavophiles in particular are using Hegelian terms. They're not using it. They're not copying it. They have no interest in importing that stuff here. That was the language of philosophy. And so they use it. There's a very fine line there. When I first read Hegel, I realized that he was extremely valuable, that he was a Christian man and it's very usable in laying out a foundational Orthodox philosophy. And slowly but surely it dawned on me. And of course, his philosophy of right was a subject. My master's thesis was on the philosophy of right, one of the greatest works of conservatism in the true sense ever written. Because it's so inaccessible, it doesn't get treated as such. Karl Marx, often is seen as a protege, which is ridiculous. They didn't have much in common. Marx primarily came from Feuerbach and Hesse and that movement, rather than Hegel, who had died, quite a bit before. Marx's doctoral dissertation was on Lucretius and the materialists of the pre-Socratic era. So it's a problem when you're reading Losef or anyone like him. You have to know your Hegel very, very well, and therefore you have to know your Kant very, very well. And if you don't, you're going to sound foolish. And there's a lot of assumptions that when you write this kind of philosophy, you're laying out foundations. You're not talking about arguments in favor of the faith. You're talking about what would constitute proof in the first place, what would constitute evidence, or how would cognition go when you're discussing these things. He's known for several things, and he's just, I think he's not known in the West because he's very good. philosophers known in the West are just, you know, guys who play word games and the useless characters like that, the analytic nonsense, that morass, has destroyed philosophy for most people. The real philosophers around the world remain unread and unknown. He used Hegelian language. He spoke of primarily metaphysics, and he's extremely convincing to those who know the language. Like everything else, you need someone who knows the material to slowly enculturate you into the thing. You can't just pick up a book. That's not how it works. You have to know everything he says before you know anything he says. And because he's using words in a very specific way. One of the main axioms, and I think is almost irrefutable, is that for there to be any multiplicity, there has to be unity first. There has to be a singularity before we can even talk about something coming from that, a multiplicity. So anytime there is a group of things that we could organize into a set, the assumption is that there's something from which they come that gives them that quality by which we can organize them. One of his main terms, used very technically, is myth. The concept of myth is one of these words that has lost all sense of its original meaning. A myth is something very, very good, very, very true. It is not a lie. It is not storytelling in the sense we use the term. It's something true. I've said and will continue to say that the stories of the gods and goddesses of Egypt or Greece and Rome were never meant to be believed. They're not real people. They were not meant to be seen that way. Hesiod didn't think that he was Muhammad, you know, receiving revelation from on high. He was just writing down stories. It was the best way and an effective way of encoding knowledge. The constitution of these societies could be found in the stories of these gods and goddesses, and that's why they were civic events. They would have feasts and the plays, or the great plays that would talk about their deeds and their human proteges on earth, were civic events, political events. They were times of catharsis. The word religion is overused. The word God is overused. These were archetypes in the broad sense. Any act in Loss's mind has to come from a sense of self. I stated that to understand anything Loss says, you have to know everything he said. This is paradoxical because that's not how we learn. So you're talking about immersion and induction or initiation, rather than just a linear study of concepts. And that's the case for Hegel as well. What we have, when we perceive something, and this is the case in Russian philosophy all over the place, when we perceive something, we're deliberately focusing our attention on an object, an arbitrary object. I mean, we're not, you know, we're separating it out from other objects because we need to. Our brain, though, is aware of a massive amount of material that it has to block out. There's no getting out of that. And even when we look at an object, we realize that we're only looking at a little piece of it, an aspect of it that's appealing to us, that we need at the moment. But the primary work of the brain in this case is to block out everything else around it. Any action, any move that we make of any kind, especially the things of social or civic importance, implies that we're doing this from a very strong foundation. It's not an arbitrary action. And the ultimate foundation for all things, the unity from which everything else comes, is myth. The best way to put it is that myth is the meta-reality. It's even broader than Dasein and Heidegger. Myth is the background of our day-to-day life such that we can interpret our own acts and those of others and make sense out of them. It's a set of stories that have a lot in common that are told in one form or another that make a society a society. These are the things that bind people together in all forms, and not just politically, it's in every way. Our understanding of even basic argument. How do we make a philosophical argument? What constitutes proof? How do we know if we're thinking or feeling? These kind of questions are ultimately found in the foundation. You can't have anything. Nothing is beyond myth, because you couldn't even, it would be a contradiction. You couldn't even conceive of it. Myth is that which makes any action possible. It's deeper than any set of institutions. It's deeper than any set of ideas. Like everything of value, it can't be written down. 99% of it is impossible to write down. Or if you could, it would be volume to volume for the smallest thing. This means, though, that all that we see is interconnected. That we are arbitrary. You know, we single out an object, and a part of an object, we're being arbitrary. There's nothing special about one aspect of matter that we call a name versus other things right next to it. We differentiate one thing from another because we need to. Ultimately, our brain sees, especially in our state, reality as just this flux of images and ideas. We kind of pin down reality and definition for that reason. We take a little chunk out of this huge flux of things that we see every day, and we give it a name because it's useful to us. Subject and object end up being the same thing. Reality is that which human beings project onto this flux. That means the world that we see is different compared, depending on our moral state. This is a central concept in Orthodox philosophy of any kind. There is no given. Well, there is in reality, but we don't know that. The way that we live our lives, the assumptions that we make, are always projected onto everything around us. We give it a certain color. So little children don't see the world the way we do. Saints certainly do not. They see more of it. One of the central ideas in Losef is that the purpose of dialectic is, it's not about negation of some thesis. It's a phrase, Hegel never even used that terminology. Dialectics is about taking an object and showing what it is in its entirety, as well as its connections to everything else. Any object you could take in your hand, you just take a soda can. Well, analyzing it, you see that the geometry is used everywhere. These proportions are exact. And so you have the history of mathematics and how we view the world right there. And then metalwork, aluminum. We're talking about international trade and bauxite. We're talking about how the methods of metalworking have developed over the centuries. We're talking about mass production. Then we have to talk about how the can is painted. It's designed to tease the eye. We can go on and on and on. Every little bit has a tremendous history. You can tell the story of the entire world in a soda can, because every aspect of it is a result of some very deeply, very old historical process. You couldn't make these perfect circles that we have in the top unless you had this, you know, a tremendous ability to create standardized production techniques. So philosophy, right down to any object we may see, is intensely historical and intensely social. Sometimes Losef will use the term absolute. He's not using it in a Hegelian sense. He's referring to myth. There can be nothing beyond it. Myth is the ultimate reality as far as our human nature is concerned. God revealed himself in the Old Testament to a group of people that already existed. He adapted, so to speak, to the culture that they were in, and continued to do so, continued to speak to them, and including the New Testament, according to these cultural norms. He didn't speak to them in a foreign language. He used language and ideas that were known to them. And as they developed as a people, as we develop as a people, that communication will change and get more sophisticated. His very, very basic, fundamental view of the world in metaphysics, and goes like this. The center of everything, of course, is God the Father. But we have no conception of that as fallen human being. We know it in word, and we can define terms, but we don't really know it. in our world, it's correspondent with the idea of myth, the meta reality from which all things have to come. You know, this is even the shared meanings even beyond language, the context in which even language developed. And that, of course, has to, like any unity, it has to expand itself. It can't just exist that way. It has to manifest itself in institutions and in ways of life. Otherwise, it's worthless. But that implies a certain becoming, that we're imperfect people. We move from a state of imperfection, hopefully, to perfection. And that's implied in the idea that this unity creates a less perfect manifestation of itself. So that's your first three. It's not meant to be the Trinity in a theological sense, but that's, you know, how the human brain works. It's a common argument. Crocus used it. John of Damascus used it. When you posit God the Father, you have to posit an image. He has to think. He has to think of himself. Well, that thought is also God, and therefore equal to him. You can't get away from that. Any unity has to manifest itself somehow. Our personality, if we're completely integral, our personalities can't just, not act. We were always acting. And that leads to the fourth thing, which is realization. Realization is, you remember, the concept of perfection didn't mean that it had no flaws. Perfection normally meant not needing anything outside of it, being completely self-contained. Our vision as Orthodox people, for example, doesn't require any input from the modern world to make it better. But we use concepts and we have to use, a lot of what it offers, and it's not all bad. But our vision is entirely self-contained. Therefore, it's perfect. We don't need, we need no input from anyone else. It's done. It's taken care of. And then the last thing, the lowest, so to speak, the lowest and least perfect aspect of this is expression. And that's the concept of symbol. Symbol is the word that probably the most irritating of English words, because it has no bearing at all. It means the opposite of what it meant a few hundred years ago. A symbol is how society manifests its myth. It is not something without substance. In fact, it's quite the contrary. It's the gateway to substance. It's a way to express something very powerful, that powerfully such that you can't use words. That's why we have poetry, and that's why we have music, because words are weak, and we have certain experiences that only can be expressed that way. And I mentioned this concept of intuition, which is this realization that when we focus on anything, any object, any X, most of what we're doing is blocking out everything else, which is a huge amount of work. Our consciousness is confronted by a massive amount of material, no matter what we do. We open our eyes and if we were to analyze it piece by piece, it would never end. The brain has to deal with this. And in our fallen state, it's not just a mechanism. Our own sins and problems and biases also go into filtering this. We have to focus on a few things. And so you consider the intuition, this background stuff, the cosmos, everything, the all. That's what's intuited. We don't have to think about it. It's our immediate connection with the world around us. And that includes ourselves, and it includes our consciousness in that. The consciousness isn't somehow separated from all of this. So the idea of dialectic is to take any object and to expand. And this is what history is. This is what myth does. Over time, objects in our cultural world, and that's really redundant, because any object would be cultural by definition. The purpose of our development intellectually is to overcome unknowing, to overcome the idea that we're looking at something, any particular object or set of objects, in an imperfect way, only one little piece of it. We're constantly deepening it. We're constantly connecting it with other things. We start realizing that any practice, say farming contains chemistry. It contains economics. It contains meteorology. It contains religion, because we're talking about the final end of these things. Why is it that things grow and they're constantly striving to realize something that you can possibly predict in a seed? Our own work, order versus chaos, being subject to nature and weather, things like that. You know, farming, therefore, is this tremendous universal concept. But everything, any practice that we might hold to, when it's viewed, so the point is, you're taking every little bit of that and expanding it and deepening it in every way possible. The deeper that goes, the greater the knowledge, and therefore the greater mastery over the practice. Another way of putting that is that you have now stamped order upon that which is chaotic. The problem I mentioned in terms of debating is that most people are completely unaware of why they believe what they believe or why they're doing what they're doing. They'll tell you a story. That's a myth in a bad sense, that they're objective thinkers, or that, you know, they believe in some ideal that everyone is wonderful. And that's never true, or at least only a tiny part of the truth. All of us have deeply psychological reasons, going back to our past, how we've processed information, things way beyond our control, way beyond what's going on in our subconscious at any given time, how the archetypes in our collective will are always being changed and challenged. Most of the time, we are unaware of the overwhelming majority of the reasons for our motivation and what we do. Everyone knows this. And it's something that it's hard to deal with, because the deeper psychology goes, the more problems we have. Every tiny aspect of consciousness then is continually expanded into more and more questions and more problems. It gets deeper and deeper and deeper and more, almost to the point of infinity. Baruch Spinoza, and as well as Hegel, defined a free action as that action in which we are the exclusive cause. In other words, that we have overcome all these subconscious causes. We understand them. We put them in their place. And so we act completely in collective. We say we're common, collected. This is what we mean. Collected means you're taking all of these other motives, things that drive us. You're taking them out of the subconscious and you're making them conscious. That means we have a mastery over them. We're aware of them, and we can rank them accordingly. The only free action, therefore, is one where you know the entire gamut of causes that have you believe what you believe and therefore do what you do, which is a tremendous amount of work. Therefore, most acts are not free. And people act unfreely because they really truly believe that in doing the wrong thing, they're fulfilling some great purpose. Over time, people start to believe the nonsense they tell themselves. Sin is not the act, you know, a bad act. That's way too juridical. It's the entire personality. It's the entire persona. Sin is an imperfection in how we have organized our own thinking. That we have deliberately left stuff in the subconscious so we don't have to deal with it. St. Ignatius of Brunchaninov says that, the demonic elements are always in the subconscious. So there they can hide, and they could pretend, or have you pretend, that your actions are free when they're not. People who have to play protesting, you know, Donald Trump, will give you a line that they are in favor of equality. Trump is going to start a nuclear war with Algeria, whatever these idiots think. But that's never true. No one does these things for abstract reasons. There's a whole gamut of motives, some good, some bad, that they're unaware of or don't want to be aware of, that it would take books and books and books to ever analyze. Their actions aren't free. And they're not free partially because they're not based on any truth at all. But they're also not free because they're unaware of why they're doing what they're doing. There was a study about 30 years ago on the Belgian Communist Party, which I didn't know existed until the other day. I read it fairly recently. They were concerned why members joined it. And they spouted all the slogans, but when they got down to it, it was because they really wanted to be a part of something that had a great moral purpose. It had nothing to do with labor. It had nothing to do with dialectics. It had to do with that they loved being a part of something that that gave them a sense of being part of a cause, being a part of something, a movement, making history, that kind of thing. That's really what motivated them. And it's almost like it's really who got to them first, which particular movement got to them first. They loved the idea that they were rebellious, but given the nature of the West, they were not punished for being communists like you would be for being a national socialist. So it was a cause that made them seem radical, but was not really a sacrifice. It didn't cost them anything. So really was a perfect thing. Now, they're not going to admit that, that that's their motive, but it is. You know, you look at a male feminist, and, you know, we can go through the list of twisted emotions, these half-baked hormonal things that are going through their system, that's driving them to hate themselves, to wish more punishment on themselves. Or, you know, what we really read, you know, we know a lot of why these guys are there. They want women to like them. They want to be held in esteem. They want to be one of the girls, you know, and maybe they'll have rewards for them down the road. There's a lot of women who don't trust that, and they shouldn't. So, but getting into their motives would be, you know, would take months of discussion. The point is that nothing they're doing is free, because they only know a tiny speck of what's motivating them, and that's probably not true. In the way we view the world, the image of something is never real. This is something you see in Skovoroda, you see it in Plato. It can't be proven. It's fleeting. An image can never be the basis of anything. You can't have any knowledge of images, except in a negative way. Nominalism, of course, is very opposite of this point of view. And it's rejected for a whole bunch of reasons. One of the main ones is that being is too historical. This myth is the most non-nominalist thing you could possibly ever come up with. Matter and how we generate images from it is completely fluid. I've used the example before. It's very common that the passionate side of the soul, as Plato talks about, Rostov talks about, can only look at images. It can only deal with colors and contours and feels. That's what the passionate drives are focused on. That's what motivates it. There's not a man in the history of the world that's ever been aroused by a chemical analysis of the female body, or an abstraction of the female body, or some anatomical, you know, deeply mathematical analysis of the chemicals in a woman's body. That's not what motivates them. No, it's the actual image that they pick up in their senses. Very specific, very vivid. No one has ever been aroused by the concept of a woman. That's a very important thing to realize, that that kind of arousal, sexual or otherwise, only exists at the level of images, only exists at the level of non-essential thing. Now, part of what makes a saint is that they actually can see the beauty not in the Epicurean sense, but they could see beauty in logos, manifest in that person. They've gone beyond being triggered, so to speak, by those curves and everything that we love about women. They go beyond that, and they could see what's real, what most of us can't see when we're confronted with something like that. The truth is, though, that logos is present there. Our reaction are the result of, you know, a completely, a very complex human nature. We're responding to very specific things. We're not really aware of that because our hormones kick in and we do crazy things. But the important thing is that it's part of this huge complex of how life is created, this force in us that's then part of and connected to everything else in the cosmic order. That's the reality. We get focused on one little aspect of that experience and in our arousal to women, such that everything else gets clouded. And we all know what that's like. Now, the issue is, when you, through the ascetic life, The ascetic life is meant to slowly erase the purely nominal, specific, image-based perceptions and go far deeper. That body, I don't care how beautiful it is, it's going to die, and it's going to rot, and it's going to be eaten by maggots, and it's going to be disgusting, and it's going to smell. Really, when the mystery's gone with a woman, you lose all that drive anyway. When you see them, you know, in day-to-day life, and you see them sick and everything else, it goes away very, very quickly. It's fleeting. This is why images don't mean anything. It's the lowest level of perception. Unless there's something else there, you have no relationship there. It has to go beyond that. And it has to be far beyond that. And in material objects and how they affect us and how they provoke the will, the intellect has to dominate and say, this is why. We're giving you now a list of causes that's motivating that response to seeing a woman or seeing anything like that or seeing a pile of money or seeing a business opportunity. And you can hardly contain yourself. You got to get in on this before someone else does. Those drives are unfree. What they mean and how they fit into the cosmic order is another matter. Within any mythic construct, which is really a civilization or a society, Losef is also known for his doctrine of names. He did come down on the side of the name-worshipping idea, but his view was very crude and very extreme. I've said many times that name-worshippers don't believe that the name of God, you know, Jesus, Yahweh, whatever, is actually God present like it would be in the Eucharist. I think Losef did. And it was very odd because the man is intensely logical, and yet he seems to believe this. But even beyond the theological issues, his doctrine of names is extremely important. Remember, one of the reasons that name worship is being so badly handled is that no one knows what it means. A name or a word is not what we think it is. Most languages see a word as an idea, as a Platonic archetype. We see it as letters on a page. That's what nominalism does to people. It destroys their sense of reality. A word or a name, as terms, refer to everything contained in the conceptual apparatus that we use to describe something. It's not the name of God. That's never been the issue. That's ridiculous. The concept is what the name is, what the word is all of the apparatus intellectually. It could be ritually or it could just be intellectually that we use to describe and understand and love aspects of God's presence, what we know about him. The entire whether it be the books or the icons or the feelings or the smell, all of that taken together. The concept of an idea, one of the ways that he departed from Plato in that respect, is that he refuses to remove the physical elements from it. The Platonic idea does have matter, because that's very much a part of, you know, how we react to, say, a female body is not in and of itself evil, and it should not be excluded from the archetype, because there'd be no babies if that were the case. So he doesn't want to just make this purely ethereal conception. He wants to include the emotional. He wants to include the physical. He wants to include the psychological and even the irrational in the sense of not being logical. It could be above or below. A name or a word, when it was used in the ancient world, was used in the medievals, even up until, you know, 100 years ago, a name was not just a word. Nominalism says that. That's why nominalism is so deadly. No, a name is a complex of emotional, rational, physical things that's symbolized in a name in the sense that we name ourselves, the name of an object, but equally connected to that is how we describe the object, which is also its name. It's not just one word that we use. It's public. It's known to all. So it has to be communicated. It's not a name in that sense unless everyone knows what it is. It can't be private, you know, your own psychotic world. It has to have, and this is where it gets tricky, it has to have a communion with a referent. A name that we know, we're talking about just a word. A name we use to describe something has to be connected with that something. It's not just an arbitrary set of sounds. And etymology has a tendency to back us up on this. that separating the words we use and how we verbalize things, the name and the object, is a mistake. It's not arbitrary. These things have the names and descriptions that they have because they're real. He never says that the name and the thing are the same. If that were the case, the description of something would be the something. That's not true. So there's got to be something else. But it has to have an agreement. There has to be, I started off talking about the nature of debate. There has to be a communion there. We have to have a lot in common before we could even begin talking. And we have to understand what we mean. The name, the description, the concepts has to have a direct and immediate connection to the thing that's being described. Otherwise, you become a psychotic. You have created your own private world that no one knows anything about, that completely is nothing more than your projection onto this flux of intuition. It also affirms a purpose. It tells us what it is, what it does. It gives a limit. It gives borders and boundaries. You know, we see the world as discrete objects because we've been trained that way. It's useful to us. Newborn babies probably don't. They see nothing but swirls and images. We have to teach them to pin it down. This is the manifestation of myth. The one, the many, becoming, the realization, and then the symbol. Now we're at the level of symbol. And we're also talking about Plato's forms. Losev was primarily a Platonist, and he dealt with Plato most of his career. And he has five elements to describe the forms. I found of all the philosophers writing on Plato, Losev has been the most useful in understanding the form. The form, the form is absolutely essential to Plato. Without that, he's meaningless. It's the center of all Western thought. It's the center of the spiritual world. Without Plato, nothing happens. Without Plato's forms. A form is a disembodied reality that gives specific objects their defining qualities. So we have a concept of goodness. We also see individually good acts. What a bunch of good acts, millions of good acts taken together, what they have in common is goodness. That goodness is real. It's created. It's part of God's mind. And it's the unity that comes before the multiplicity. Otherwise, it's all nonsense. We're arbitrarily saying that things are good that really don't know what we're talking about. We see a lot. We could talk about good acts with philanthropy, intellectually good acts, physically good acts, a good law, a good doctor, a good lawyer. All of these are good. It seems odd because there's a lot of different situations. We're all using the same word. Well, unless there's a concept of goodness that's separate from all of those things, then we're crazy. We're just being lazy. We're calling good can mean anything. You know, words like love, I mean, don't get me started on that. It's used for anything. There has to be a central living entity that exists long before we could start applying it to individual things. The unity has to always come before the thing. Objects don't exist in a vacuum. They exist because there is a creator. There's a unifying world. There's a myth in our social sense. So the first thing that happens is that in Plato's dialogues, there's a manifestation of corruption. Usually it has something to do with words. That someone is talking about, it could be piety, it could be courage, friendship, it doesn't matter. And someone's using it in a self-interested way. They're defining it as they see fit. They're defining it so that they're rationalizing a certain position of power that they may have, for example. And so Socrates points out that what we just said, the concept, there's a separation between the use of the language and the world around it. The language that they're using has no real reference. The language that they're using is kind of custom-made for themselves to justify their position. And often they have the power to like get other people to think that too. That's why the sophists were such a big problem for him. The words take on a life of their own, which means that not only could you define what goodness is, but you could tell people what a good act is and what it isn't. You could completely redefine their word, their world, if you're that powerful, like the American media has been. There's the idea of the fact. Something is true, but in our social life, something is true only if our terms are defined first. So again, the unity has to come first. You know, we have to know what a swan is before we see a swan, or else we wouldn't know what it is. There's also, you know, the concept, it can't be the same thing. The form has to be separated from the instantiation of the form. The form exists prior to it. The unity exists always prior to the aspect. And ultimately, the highest level is number. When Plato or Augustine use the word number, he's not talking about digits. Numbers are icons. Unity, multiplicity, one and two. They're icons of the world. So what we try to do here is give the very, very foundational concepts of what the world is. God creates humans to live in society. To live in society, they have to believe in myths, in the true sense of the word. The myth is the entire cultural complex of everything that we are. And we found in stories and images, you know, it's almost infinite, the amount of material. You have to have all that and understand what it means before you could even make a move. Our societies, racially or ethnically, religiously, they have to be deeply unified and homogenous. Because the cultural stories that we have are very delicate. We have to know all the details. We can't have a debate with someone unless we have the same mythic background. You have to have the same goals, have the same reason to have the same goals. We don't have the same goals, or we can't speak the same language, or that there's so many subcultures that no one knows how to talk to each other anymore, or that even reason itself is being disparaged. You don't have a society. And that kind of chaos. Chaos is based on ignorance, as we said. Only the most fanatical, cohesive groups ever dominate, which is why liberalism has always been connected with the so-called emancipation of the Jews. And that's why they have grown admirably in power, because they have maintained their cohesiveness as everything else is falling apart around them. But this kind of falsity, evil acts, this is all based on a lack of knowledge. You don't know what's motivating you. Knowing these motivations is central to any kind of mental health. You have to know the full gamut of things that have you act. And if you don't know it, you have to refrain from acting until you do. The myth is directly from God. It's directly from Logos. Because human beings can't be human beings without myth. We can't even use the word without this civilizational backdrop. And the institutions and ideas and laws derive from it, including the laws of thought. And all of this implies that we are educated in the true sense of the word from a state of ignorance to a state of knowing. We come to some level of realization, and in the process, we express that development in terms of symbols. That's the foundational concept of the world. It rejects any concept of individuals in the nominalist sense. There's no self-interest there. You know, they're not so naive as to be able to summarize in a few words what motivates people. That's utter nonsense. But part of that symbolism is to be found in the name. And all of this taken together is what we refer to as myth. This is even greater than Heidegger's Das Sein always comes up in my mind when I read Lossen. But it's even deeper than that. It is the entire it's the entire history of human development in this huge intuitive almost infinity that we perceive when we confront the cultural world. Now we can't get it all at once, of course, so we block it out and we focus on a few things. But that's what generates the laws of thought, the laws of what's good and bad, what's real and what is not. We live in an era, of course, where the myth has been shattered and has been replaced by something else. And it's been replaced by things that serve a certain group, and it creates chaos and death and destruction wherever it goes. And the results, among other things, is that discussion, debate, actual community is now increasingly impossible. So thank you for listening. This is the foundation of what we do here. I understand this is very abstract, but I'm an abstract guy, so I think you guys will live. I thank you for listening. My enemies, if you don't understand this, it's because you're stupid. That's why you're my enemies. But otherwise, I thank my supporters. I thank Matt Heimbeck and my parrot, Sven Longshanks, everyone else who's assisted me in this. And I appreciate them very much. And I will talk to you next time. Goodbye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.